6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. I was born in Butte, Montana, 1947, September 17th. Now, to those interested, that's 6 months before or after St. Patrick's Day. I was born in the old St. James Hospital, and I live in the same house where I was born and raised. I've been there 61 years, except for a short move across the street. My mother's maiden name was Lynch, and she married a Lynch, and they were not related. And her first name was Queenie, which caused me a problem in grade school. They would come to me and say, what is your name? And I'd say, I'm Johnny Lynch. And they'd say, okay, what was your mother's maiden name? And I said, Lynch. And no, 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 what name before she was married? And I said, Lynch. So they went on to the next question, what is your mother's name? And I said, Queenie. And they, no, no, her real name. And I said, Queenie. So the nun at St. Pat's called my mother and said, we have some very bad news for her. I think this was either in the kindergarten or first grade. We have an idea that your son John is a little slow, that he thinks your maiden name was the same as your married name, and he thinks that your real name is Queenie. And when she informed the nun that my son, her son, was in fact okay, that the nun should have realized, the nun apologized. So that's where I grew up, and went to St. Pat's grade school my entire life, which was only a block in one direction, and then went to Butte Boys Central High School, which was a block in the other direction. So I've always told my children throughout their lives that I walked back and forth school every day, which of course was easy for me to be able to do. Then I, of course, got out of Central and went to Western Montana College, where I served as student body president there, and also served as governor of College Kiwanis, Circle K, while I was attended Western Montana College. That's the prelims, kind of, until we get to when I lost my mind completely and ran for the legislature.
Well, that's great, and that's great to have that background. I'm interviewing J.D. Lynch, whom you just heard from. J.D. was a state senator, state representative from, what, 70 to 78?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
From here in Silver Bowl County, and then a state senator from...
82 to 99.
82 to the election of 2000, I guess.
Yes, actually until 2001.
I got you.
Yep.
Okay, and the interview is being conducted here at Montana Tech in Butte, Montana on September 25th. 2008. And so we've got you through college. You're back here in Butte. What did you do for a living?
I came back to Butte immediately. Was fortunate enough, because there was some movement in the school district, to get a job at Butte High School. And from that day forward, every time I was asked what I did in Butte, I always told them I taught English as a foreign language at Butte High School. And I taught in the English department there for 8 years, and then I went on and taught at the VOTEC, and then again at the alternative school. And I spent 32 years in the school district here in Butte.
And in the very early beginning of this time, apparently when you were an English teacher in the high school, that's when you first ran for the legislature?
No, actually I ran for the legislature prior to getting the job.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I graduated from college in 1969, and I ran for the legislature in 1970. I was nominated, which virtually in those days was the election in Butte, in June of 1970, and I started my teaching career in September of 1970.
That same year?
Yes.
So you, as your first year as a teacher, spent time over in Helena as a legislator?
My first year as a teacher, I took a leave of absence in January for, at those times we only had the 60-day sessions, we were gone.
Except that in that particular one,
we had a long,
served in, that was a long one.
Special session.
Yeah. So that,
but the special session was in June.
Didn't it go past March
not,
on the regular?
Not very long, because we stopped. You'll have to correct me if I'm wrong. We had a 21-day, I believe, session in June.
Yeah, that's probably right.
Yeah,
yeah, that's probably right. So what motivated you to run for the legislature?
I think that I came from a fairly political family. You know, I was watching Adlai Stevenson and Dwight Eisenhower, and I was fascinated by politics. And I had an aunt that I called aunt, but she really was my mother's aunt. My mother had no sisters, and her mother died when she was, I think, two. So she was raised by what I always called the matriarchy of all aunts. And one was an aunt named Loretta Sullivan, whose husband, Dan D., had been a county commissioner, and then he had died. And in Butte, that was very common, that the wife would then take over, and she ran on her own right and won. So I knew we were, quote, a political family. And then, without a doubt, the thing I think the most motivated me and so many people of my generation and your generation was in 1960. I was, of course, an Irish Roman Catholic, and John Fitzgerald Kennedy truly inspired a whole generation of us, not only with his ideas, but I think with his oratory, his charisma, his looks. I mean, I used to imitate him forever. No, what your country could do for you, but rather what you could do for your country. And I'd go on and on and on. And I can remember in 1960, in October, the biggest game of the year, and I don't remember the exact date, was Butte Central playing Butte High School. That was the big... And here I am, 13 years old, handing out J.F. Kennedy cards to the folks going in and not watching the game. I was also handing out Lee Metcalf cards, Paul Cannon cards, Donald Olson cards. I can remember the whole crew. I especially was offended by Paul Cannon's because they were orange and black. And an Irishman handing out an orange card sets his little something against it. But I did it anyway.
He was from here in Butte, too.
Yes, he ran
a... better than that.
Yeah, he ran a haberdashery, a women's store, Cannon's Women's Store in Butte.
Huh. What do you remember about that first campaign for the legislature?
I think that when I was student body president in 1969 at Western, the big issue then, and I think it's a legitimate issue today, although I think we've fouled it up miserably, the federal government along with the state governments, was the Vietnam War and whether or not a person, in fact, ought to have to go to war. There's a key word there, have to. And die before he or she ever had an opportunity to vote for the people that sent them. So we were, of course, suggesting that 18-year-olds had a right to vote. As the student body president, I joined the other student body presidents from the various campuses. A couple of them were for Butte. I remember Eddie Leary was U of M's student body president. And I'm trying to think, there was one other that was from Carroll, I think it was a Butte. And we went there, and I was kind of a little upset. I think the lack of, well, for choice of a better word, the lack of respect that the office holders of the student campuses received from the legislature. In retrospect, maybe it wasn't as bad as I thought, because I, after 30 years in the legislature, I realized how busy those are. But they gave us very little time and said, you know, thanks, but no thanks for coming. And so I was a little upset. I might also add, while in at Dillon, I also became involved as Tom Judge's campaign manager on campus for lieutenant governor. At those times, we nominated governor and lieutenant governor separately. And so I was the camp. And Dillon, at that time, had very few Democrats. I kind of realized how Republicans felt in Butte later on, having their huge meeting in the telephone booth. But that's how it was in Dillon, and Judge did very well. He was the JC president, former president, and a fellow named Jim Flynn in Dillon asked me to, and Tom Judge and I went to the Labor Day rodeo together, and he was successful for lieutenant governor, and then again, he ran for governor in 72 and won that, and Forrest Anderson didn't run again.
Yeah.
And then I went to Boise State also, and was extremely surprised when I met Governor Babcock and how short he was. Because, you know, on TV, you think people are, and both he and Forrest Anderson, who ran against each other, were very short stature. And of all the political slogans in my lifetime, that I'll said the best four words ever in an election, then, now, or probably is pay more, what for, was the, probably whoever came up with that, virtually elected Forrest Anderson governor of the state of Montana.
Being against the sales tax.
It's sales tax.
1968.
And I learned a great lesson being opposed to the sales tax. I used it as my base for many years in the state legislature.
So you were motivated to run for the legislature by this years of interest in politics that went back to...
And I think the rejection or what I thought, perceived to be a rejection by the legislators of young people's voices.
Yes.
A lot of people accuse me of never having been young, that I was born old. But when you're 19 or 20 and you go there with the expectation of being treated, and I wasn't, not my delegation, and I'm not being specific about anybody. I thought the general tenure of the legislature in those years was, so what? And also, I told my mother I was going to run for legislature, and she said, oh, don't do that. Please don't do that. And I thought, what have I got to lose? I'm, 22 years old. But she said, people think we might have a little influence. When you get B, we won't show we don't have any. So that spurred me, but it also spurred her to make sure that I didn't lose the election.
So what about that first campaign? Was it
first
a contested
campaign? Was most interesting because we didn't have single-member districts. There was three open spots, and that's one of the reasons that it looked attractive.
How many elected from Silver Bowl?
Seven.
And there were four incumbents.
Four incumbents, and Pat Williams was not running that year, and Ray Wernerman was not running that year, and I think one of the Tracys were running for the Senate. So there was three open seats of the seven, and 15 ran. And it was with very few exceptions, certainly 90% of every door in Silver Bowl County. I wasn't teaching then, remember?
Yep.
So I had the entire spring to hit the doors, and all I had, I think the filing fee was, was it $10?
10 or 15.
It's still 15, I think.
Yeah.
And so I had a few small cards printed up, a lot of small little cards, handout cards, and then a few posters that were what would be described as ancient now. I also had hair then, so I had a picture that I was quite proud of at the time. But campaigning in Butte was, I liked campaigning. I would go to the corner of Park and Main in Butte. Now, you couldn't do it now, but remember there were three shifts of miners getting off every 8 hours, and so you could virtually give out 1,000 cards right on the corner of Park and Main. On Friday, you'd go up to North Main Street where the pay office was, and before they got to Packy Buckley's Classic Bar, and you would hit probably 1,500 miners getting their paychecks. So you could do a great deal of work in a short time. And then, I didn't want to go too early, so every morning about 10, I would go out door to door and stop about 5 o'clock, and that's when you hit the housewives. And
sure.
And I remember that one lady, in fact, her husband later became a legislator. They were for lefty winners, and I went to the door, and it was Kathy Pavlovich, whose husband later joined us in legislature, and it was pouring rain out. Well, when I'm already 5 blocks from the car, it doesn't make much sense to walk back 5 blocks in the rain to get in the car, so I just kept trudging away, and Bobby came home that night, and she says, I'm voting for lefty, but I know who my second vote is. That young kid that came to the door in the middle of a rainstorm. He must want it pretty bad. And remember, at that time, you could vote for up to 7. So if you gave 2 votes, that's
sure.
Better than... a fascinating race. I've always liked giving a speech. I was on the speech to drama team in college. I was a thespian. I always have to make sure you know what I'm talking about. It reminds me of the story of the fellow in Florida when he ran against... what was the old congressman's name?
Claude Pepper.
Smathers told everybody in the back hills of Florida that Claude Pepper's sister was a thespian and his brother was a homo sapien. Everybody said, we're not voting for that guy in a million years. So, and I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed going to that. And at that time, Butte was the key. We had our, this is kind of interesting historically, I think. To my knowledge, it was the last big campaign dinner prior to the general election was at the Columbia Gardens in a huge pavilion, and it closed down, I think, the following year. So that was a big gathering place, and that's when you got to meet, not only that you were running, you were excited, but then you got to meet people that, my God, here's Forrest Anderson, or here's... Mike Mansfield, a giant in my mind, and my mother and all my aunts, and Lee Metcalf, and here I'm rubbing shoulders with the big people. So it was a fascinating. I loved it. I think I loved the campaign more than I liked winning. I won that night in November.
You remember where you placed?
I came in fourth.
Right in the middle of the
right in the middle of the pack. Yeah. I beat one incumbent. I forget which one. I think Healy might have come first, and the other three incumbents beat me. I was fourth in an incumbent, and then I think Joe Quillacy was fifth or sixth, and Bob Harper was running up the tail at seventh. I think we had three or four Republicans who thought maybe if they single low, but they, especially countywide, they weren't going to win any place. And that night I asked to leave my victory party, which was at my house. We didn't have any. And I came up here to the School of Mines where we're doing this interview, all by myself, and I looked over this rail where you could see all of you, and I went, oh boy. And I wasn't sure. I really wasn't sure how important a legislator was. I knew I had some ideas, but I said, gee, there's Butte, and here I'm representing it. And I felt very proud and at the same time very, very fearful, hoping I could do a good job, because there had been some in the past who tried to do a good job and they kind of messed up in Helena. And here I was, I wanted to make my family proud, but I also wanted to make all the people that supported me. And there were, you know, lots of just, you know, I was the youngest ever elected up to that time. You know, out of Silver Bow County, I would have been, had it not been for this jerk from Flathead, I would have been the youngest elected up to that time in the state. But it was an exciting night and an exciting time.
What's changed in the politics of Butte and Silver Bow since then?
I think there are several things that have changed. What I think there was a mistake made, but the Republicans, of course, would disagree with me, but when they eliminated partisan races for local races, you virtually eliminated much of the strength of your Democratic Party. Republicans didn't have any strength to begin with, so it didn't matter to them. But I've noticed in the last 20 or 30 years since they've done it, I think they did in 78 maybe, is that the dinners don't have as many people. You know, in the old days, up to the time of the consolidation, if you were the county treasurer, you had your entire staff at the treasurer's office. If you were the county sheriff, you had your staff. The clerk or recorder had her. You'd have 100 people just from the office holders. That's all gone. And, of course, the only partisan races locally are the legislature.
Yeah.
So it's very difficult for the Democrats or the Republicans in other counties. I don't think it's just a Democrat problem. It's a Democratic problem greater in Silver Bow. But anybody who had a huge, strong Republican, we still have central committees, but half the time they get in a fight with each other. But I think that's eliminated much of what I call the Democrat power base of Butte.
And the fact, too, that there's so much less mining now.
Yeah.
Right? There are fewer miners.
Fewer union members. Yeah, Miners Union was one of the biggest unions in the nation of miners, and we were number one. Miners Union was number one. And you had, and I'm going to throw out some figures that I've heard all my life. You know, you had approximately, before the mines closed down, you had one open, the Kelly, but before they went to open pit mine, which they started in the mid-50s, you know, you had 10,000 underground miners that were getting off work, like I say, every. And then eventually they all shut down, and then the Kelly was still running, and then open pit mining when they opened the Berkeley pit. But it really didn't come to great fruition until they got rid of Meaderville and McQueen and East Butte. But open pit mining required far less employees, although they still had three shifts, but they were all pretty much truck drivers. Teamsters.
You mentioned when these fellas got off shift that one of their first stops was, did you say, Packy Buckley's bar?
Well, Packy Buckley cashed their check. The pay office was two doors above Packy Buckley's classic bar. And so they cashed the checks there.
How do you spell Packy?
P-A-C-K-Y.
I see, okay.
And the checks would be given to them. And
how come they didn't buy beer from Packy after he cashed
they did.
Their checks?
Oh, okay. They did. But a lot of times the wives were waiting for the husbands to come out before you made it to Packy. But Packy, I don't know how many thousands of dollars worth of checks he'd cash. And some wives got to a point that they insisted that checks be sent home, because some people cashed the checks at Packy's and never made any money home.
Yeah. And that culture still survives to some extent.
To some extent. There was very little I don't want to sound too liberal. I never sounded too liberal. But there was never a problem with a person who got off at the midnight shift after having gone to work at 4 o'clock in the afternoon that had any problem drinking past 2 a.m. The law was looked the other way because, you know, the guy that got off at midnight had as much right to drink as the guy got off at 4 in the afternoon.
Well, that's only fair. Yeah. That's for sure. That's for sure. Let me think here. Your first impressions of the legislature. You're feeling so excited and proud and vitally interested in representing your community.
The first thing I had to do was to go to the caucuses and, you know, kind of be told what to do because we didn't know who was going in. And the second thing, which was really interesting in my life, is to find a place to live. So my mother, Queenie, said, now, Shano, whenever she was serious, I went from JD to Shano. You find a good place, and it can't be too much because we didn't make any money. I think we made $10 a day, one way and 15 expenses, or 15 salary and 10 expenses.
Something like that.
It was the combination.
Yeah.
So I went and looked and looked, and I found a place, and I'll tell you where it was in just a second, because I told my mother first. I went home and said, Queenie, I found a nice place. And she said, what is that place, JD? I said, it's the Montana Club. And her eyebrows went up, and she said, that's a Republican place. And I said, oh, my goodness, Mom, I didn't know. And she said, how much will they be charging you there? I said, it's $1.50 a day. And I said, you have a room, and you have to go down the hall to do your duties and shave and so on. And she said, $1.50. Well, that's not a bad place, JD. So that was.
How did you stumble on?
I think we went to the Legislative Council, and there was what was the telephone guy's name? Al
Regal.
Regal. He knew that there was a few rooms. So Quillacy and I, Doc Norman from Missoula was in the house with me. A fellow I saw recently, Senator Fred Carl was there. Herschel Robbins was on that floor.
Representative from Roundup.
Roundup.
Yeah.
And I think there was like seven individual rooms. And a buck and a half a day, you're never there anyway.
Yeah.
And no women allowed. No tomatoes were allowed on that fifth floor. But it was a good experience, and a great place to be, because at one time, the Montana Club, you know, it's still just off the Gulch, was kind of the political vein of Helena.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting place to live, and I enjoyed it, and I enjoyed telling everyone that I was a big shot at the Montana Club. So then I went to my first day in session, and I'll tell the story that several people have mentioned because I got it from Paul Hatfield, but I truly sensed how he felt. I sit down, I give you your seat, your delegation, and you look around and here are people that you've seen on the local 5:30, 5 o'clock news, and you realize you're sitting in that chamber. I think the House chamber also is a terribly impressive place to walk into.
Yeah, yeah.
That Russell, you know, the last, whatever it's...
Lewis and Clark meeting the Flatheads.
It almost takes your breath away when you're actually sitting there in that chamber. Especially as you and I were at 23 years old and sitting down and looking around. And I was scared and I got appointed because Butte always had a supposed seat on Appropriations Committee. And it was asked of someone, I don't know who it was, by... Jim Lucas.
Lucas was the speaker.
The speaker. Who do you want to have the Butte seat? Obviously, the incumbents didn't particularly care. They had their own committees. So
one of the three fellows that left must have been the guy that had the seat before.
Ray Wernon, and he was a former Speaker of the House.
Yeah.
And then when he wasn't Speaker, he was... And so I got appropriations. And I didn't ask for appropriations. It was one of those things, don't ask because you're just going to be disappointed and here, you know... I asked for education, and I asked for business, and here they said, you're on appropriations, and then and education, and this, and we...
Did you realize what appropriations was? I mean,
I knew it was the money spender.
And a plum assignment?
A plum assignment. Yeah. And I had it my entire House session, my entire House career. And it was also those who have served on taxation might argue, but it's certainly, I think, the hardest working committee in the legislature, because... But it was a very... And then we were appointed to subcommittees and appropriations, and the only disappointing thing, and I'm going on too long, is that you'd work and work and work on the bill. And Bardineau was our main man, the Democrat, Francis Bardineau.
Chairman of the Appropriations Committee.
And we'd work and work and work. And then at the very end, after all of our work was done, I think it was Bob Dye came up to me.
Robert F. Dye from Bozeman.
And said, here's the bill for your committee. We had five bills in those days, as I recall. There's such a hullabaloo whether we should have one or five.
Yeah.
He said, here's your bill, signed by your chairman. I'd have to look it up now. And I said, well, I've got all these notes here. I've taken notes for the last 3.5 months or 2.5 months. What do you mean, there's the bill? Well, there's the bill. Sign it. And I said, well, I'm not signing it. Why did I just spend? And I think it made me less of a worker after that for my next 28 years.
Well, where did Dye get the bill?
I think it was in Lucas's office. They wrote the bills, the whole works, Norse Nichols.
So
you
went through the whole hearing?
And we had no input whatsoever.
And ultimately the bill was...
Maybe drawn up before we started, for all I know.
That's incredible.
But we had absolutely no input. I immediately went to Bardineau and I thought, well, maybe I'm crazy here, but all I could relate to, if that's how it's done, why did they have me up at 7 o'clock every morning?
What did he tell you?
He said, don't sign the bill. He said, it's never happened like this before. It's a power play. No Democrat signed any of those bills that session. And it kind of discouraged me from the process a little bit.
I can see why.
And then, of course, there was transparency was around the corner, I think, with the CONCON and so on.
Yeah.
But that session was, I don't know, it in some ways showed to me all that was bad about what you read about politics.
Yeah.
Back room. The other thing that fascinated me in that session was second reading. I mean, here a guy would get up and give a great oratory against the Anacana Company or against the Montana Power Company or against the telephone company, and then he'd sit down and vote completely opposite of the way he talked because they didn't record second reading. So he'd get the press being opposed to the telephone company and then vote with them. And there was nobody recorded to vote. I thought, what kind of complete hogwash is this? And people are taking pictures. After I take pictures, they chase him down and say, catch that guy, he's got a camera.
They take a picture of the voting board
to try to
get some kind of a record of how
territorial integrity, I think, was one year after.
That's what I remember, too. And that happened in that 71 session.
And that was Bob Dye, was one of our floor leaders, and he said, get that guy on that camera.
Yeah.
But I thought, well, absurd. If you want to vote that way, I'd fine.
You mentioned Francis Bardineau.
Yes.
Who, and I made him, he later was chairman of the House Appropriations
Committee. Mm-hmm, for many years.
Then he was the ranking Democrat.
Ranking Democrat.
When that incident occurred, you told me about when they handed you the bill, when you hadn't had anything to do with it and asked you to sign it. Are there other members of the legislature in addition to Bardineau that you kind of remember early on? You mentioned Jim Lucas.
Jim Lucas certainly was, I think, one of the... and I don't want to count numbers, one of the certainly the five best orators I've had in 30 years of the legislature, and I've really been there almost 38 now because I've lobbied for the last few sessions. I remember another man, rest his soul, John Hall, was another. Their debate on territorial integrity was probably one of the finest that I've ever heard.
And they had a debate on the, what was it, the coal moratorium?
Coal moratorium. That was the good debate, was the coal moratorium. And it was about 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, very late, yeah.
And Tommy Tau, I think, was one of the smartest legislators, but he unfortunately talked way too much, and no one listened to him. And he'd get up, and you'd see people pick up the newspapers, go to the bathroom, talk among themselves. But Tom Tau wanted his fingerprints on every single issue. If you said Tom Todd, our father, he'd want to amend it because he saw something that was out of place.
Yeah.
Dorothy Bradley, I thought, was a fine legislator, a little more liberal than, and that's what people don't understand for the most part in those days. Butte Democrats were completely different than Missoula Democrats. I always called us the Silvercrats. We were more interested in jobs than we were whether or not the environment was pristine. That does not mean we weren't environmentalists. Well, we believed there was a way they could you could have good jobs in a clean environment. Missoula Democrats, and still to this day to some extent, I mean, they could care less if there's any industry or anything in the state of Montana because they want to just protect. But I thought we should be more than a playground for people from out of state. And that's why I had probably more people that disliked me, not that I'm likable, disliked me for my political views on my side of the aisle than on the Republican side of the aisle, which they had no problem with people wanting to work.
Sure, yeah. Pro-business.
Yeah. But and pro-business and pro-labor, they can be together.
They can be together. Yeah. I agree with that, too. The so-called terrible twins of Montana politics, the Anaconda Company and the Montana Power Company, you hear some historians, and I've conducted interviews with other folks who talk about their enormous influence. You talk about some people who say, well, I think their influence was exaggerated somewhat. And it might have something to do with the time in which a person served there. But in your experience, when you and I both started in 1971, what were your impressions of the Montana Power Company and the Anaconda Company? Maybe you've got a story or two.
No, I don't know that I do, but I do think that their years of extreme supreme control were waning, if not gone. I hear stories that they would set the budget for the state of Montana. Anaconda would say, here's how much we're going to give you, figure it out. I also heard that in Butte Silver Bowl, that they would decide how much the gross proceeds tax or the metal mines tax and so on. And they actually at one time, you can check this out, but they were given an office in the courthouse, their bookkeeper, to figure out how much taxes.
Figure out their own taxes?
Yeah. When we got there, previously, as I understood it, Anaconda Company kind of had their way somewhat with the Butte delegation, Anaconda delegation, and had had for some time, with some exceptions. Well, I was not beholden for any job or anything to the Anaconda Company, nor was my fellow representative from Anaconda, Red Minahan. So we started voting completely contrary, and all of a sudden, the whole delegation started going that way, thinking that their power was not what it was. Hmm. And so I think that was a session that completely, was over in the 71 session.
Didn't the lobbyist, then who would it have been, Lloyd Crippen?
Lloyd Crippen, I don't think I saw Lloyd Crippen socially, other than when he was with Jim Lucas and Walter Ulmer, and there was a threesome that used to go all the time, and their wives. Denny Shea was the Democrat lobbyist,
okay.
And he would take us, of course, to dinner every so often. And the other thing, they didn't have near the bills that they apparently had before our time.
But they didn't try to work with you particularly?
Well, I remember one fellow, we had a bill called the Dust Bowl Bill. Luke McCune from Anaconda, and it was somehow to find the Anaconda Company down in Anaconda when the dust started blowing around that smelter. And Luke passed it through the Senate, and then it came to the House, and I voted for it. I thought that made sense. If they're causing the dust pollution, they should clean it up. And most of us did, except for my dear friend Jack Healy, and I said, Jack, why didn't you vote for that? The rest of us said, oh, geez, I can't be doing that. That's my department. Because he worked for the Anaconda Company, and it was his department. But that was my one good proof that times had changed, that they lobbied us on it. If you could see your way clear, and I just don't see that it would cost you that much money. And number one, if you don't clean it up, who should clean it up?
The Montana Power
Company. Montana Power Company was a different sort. And in fact, at the end of my career, in 97, I never was considered one of their fair-haired boys, as some were, because, again, I wasn't beholden to them. John Law was an excellent lobbyist, and we, of course, would go out. We were well aware that there were, I don't know, 1,400 employees in Butte, so we were not antagonistic. We certainly wanted to keep the office of the general office in Butte, Montana, so we were very respectful of them. But when it, for instance, when it came between labor and power, I'd always vote with labor because I was considered truly the labor Democrat, as were many of our delegations and Anaconda too. They were also ones that kind of led us down a primrose path. I might digress, but on territorial, I mean, on deregulation, that was probably the worst vote I made in my entire career, and I was the last one to sign it. But I don't know, when you had Butte Silver Bull saying, if you don't do this, we're going to lose all these jobs and they'll leave the office out of Butte. And if you had the Butte Local Development Corporation, you had the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and no opposition except for my environmentalists.
The IBEW supported the regulation?
Yes, Billy Ryan was a member of the IBEW, and I believe he carried it in the House.
Okay.
Yeah.
Bill who?
Bill Ryan, legislator from Great Falls.
Oh, okay. All right.
And so, but anyway.
So just to clarify for someone listening to this later on, the deregulation legislation passed in 1997 when you were in the Senate.
Yes.
So, because you left the House and moved over to the Senate sometime later on.
I left the House in 82. I went to the Senate in 82.
And the Anaconda Company ceased to exist.
It was pretty much gone. I think they shut their operations in 83.
So the Montana Power Company, though, lived on.
Yeah.
And so that was that continued to be a significant presence here in Butte.
Yeah. Yes, they had the number one. They were probably the number one employer in terms of jobs in Butte for quite some time.
And how would you characterize their influence in the legislature? Great? Was it exaggerated? Was it...
I think they had more influence than I would... I think they had great influence statewide than maybe they had in Butte. It seemed to me they were extremely influential in Republican politics. There were very few Democrats that were executives in the Montana Power Company, if any. But I do see whenever there was a good, healthy race on, and they were great gentlemen, the Corretts, but they were great friends of, you know, the Babcocks and the Republican hierarchy. And when we ran for, not me, but when the ConCon ran, Jack Corrett ran for the Constitutional Convention on the Republican ticket.
I didn't know that.
And Bob Poor, a prominent attorney, Republican here, ran on the Republican ticket for the Constitutional Convention. People thought the public in Butte might just give Jack Corrett a chance because he's done so, hired so many people, and he didn't even come in good running. But I think they did have a great influence, the executives, and nothing illegal. I just think that's the party they side with, and I think they usually had the wherewithal to donate rather handily to the Republican if they liked them.
Yeah. How about the AFL-CIO and the Funders Union?
AFL-CIO was an important and still is an important part. Not as much as they used to. There's not as many members of the AFL-CIO. But when I was first elected and for several years after, the very fact that you were endorsed by labor was an extremely important part
here
in Butte.
Yeah.
And if you weren't, that was not a good thing. Now, some people got elected without it. You know, they might be... I think Ray Wernon didn't necessarily have the labor endorsement. I was trying to think of a couple others that didn't.
Harold McGrath?
Harold McGrath never did because he was Chamber of Commerce,
that's
director of
thought,
the Chamber
yeah.
of Commerce.
Yeah.
But for the most part, in a big congested primary, you'd better have some labor endorsement if you're going to come out on one of them at the top.
Yeah.
And I always sought it and was proud of it. And to this day, I still do some lobbying for the building trades, which is the electricians and the plumbers and so on. And then I've been a union member my entire life as a bartender and later as a teacher for 32 years.
How about the Farmers Union?
Farmers Union...
Wouldn't have much influence here.
No. They were... Clyde Jarvis was one of their spokesmen who didn't care much for the Butte delegation. And one of the reasons was over territorial integrity, and there was 12 Democrats, as I recall, that voted against territorial integrity and voted in favor of, I guess you would call the power company position, and it was simply logistics for us. That's where our people worked, and if they took over some, then there would be less jobs in Butte, and there would be more power submitted by the co-ops and less power by. So. They took the picture on the wall.
Yeah, right.
And got the 12, and I think of the 12...
That was the territorial integrity vote yep. in the legislature yep.
on second reading. Yeah. And I think of the 12, 7 of the 12 were the Butte Democrats. And I think Rex Manuel or some of the other were rural. But Clyde Jarvis would get on that radio program every day and call the Dirty Dozen the Dirty Dozen.
This program is called Featuring the Facts.
Yeah. And so he wasn't fond of us, and it didn't bother us. I mean, he could send 10,000 letters to Butte saying the Farmers Union is opposed to you, and they, who is it?
You mentioned Clyde Jarvis, and you mentioned John Lahr. What do you remember about Jim Murray?
Jim Murray was, I think, a very effective... leader. He was also
Isabel CIA.
Yeah, Jim Murray. Also extremely close to the governors of Montana, Democrat governors. I know he was a close to Anderson ally and a close judge ally. I think he was also close to Swindon. But I recall one instance where my first session, I have no regrets because I didn't like the bill and I thought I was intelligent enough, but it was a bill for executive reorganization, and I think the slogan was 19 is 20 is plenty.
20 is plenty.
And I voted against it, and there were only three Democrats voted against it. Then a short time later, I got a note sent up to me from the governor's office, and I hadn't met the governor yet, and I'd been there about 5-6 weeks.
This is Governor Forrest Anderson.
Forrest Anderson, and it said the governor would like to see you now. I emphasize now with my voice, but all I said was now. So I thought, here, he's going to welcome me to Helen and welcome aboard and welcome to the team and glad to have you on the boat together. So I went down there, and I believe Joe Quillisi was with me and possibly Joe Brand, but one of the two. And I was the first one through the door because maybe I was so excited that the governor was going to be there, and I hadn't seen him since the election when we were campaigning, in Butte or someplace. I opened the door, and the first thing he says, "What the fuck do you think you're doing?" And I said, "Jesus." And I don't know, I mean, salty language was nothing new to me or anybody of my generation. But I think it did take me aback that the governor used it. When you were a little kid, you couldn't imagine adults knowing those dirty words that we thought we invented. but the governor knew them and many more. And I said, well, I just don't think it's a good idea, this executive. I kind of don't see how it's wrong the way it is. And he screamed a while and said, "You'll not be back." So I walked out
of it. He was pretty aggressive.
Oh, yeah, he wanted that. And he got it in spite of my vote.
Yeah.
But I was,
didn't change.
I was a little scared. And I walked out, and Jim Murray was there. And he said, "The governor wants this very much." And he said, you're not gonna return with the next session if you don't realize you got to get along with the governor." And I kind of got an indirect threat with me. But I said, well, I don't plan on staying here the rest of my life anyway, so okay. So, and I couldn't understand why it would be a terribly big labor road. But I went back upstairs and repeated my no vote. And the following election, I led the ticket, so I thought the threats were rather idle.
And the interesting thing about that is, too, knowing you, my guess is if his approach had been different.
Yeah.
If he'd have said,
do me a favor.
Yeah, and I this is really important to me, and I know you're new here, but just give me 5 minutes to explain to you why I think Montana needs this. You might have.
I may well have, because it wasn't that big to me, but I thought my position was right. But to suggest to me that was my last time to Helen, I thought, well, I didn't plan on staying for the next 28 years, believe me.
Any other stories about Governor Anderson that would kind of illustrate
only
his
that I think
style
I think
priority?
His style was awfully good in my I'm kind of a I don't know I don't go for the Queensberry rules. I'd rather rough and slug, and he was a battler. He was a good battler for the working stiff, for the ranchers. I think he was just a good governor. Kind of cranky, but I got to a point, some of my favorite people were cranky old guys. They're just delightful. They're not near as mean as they want to come across. But I thought Forrest Anderson was an excellent governor.
As long as we're talking about governors, you served all the way through the term in office of Tom Judge.
Mm-hmm.
what are your impressions of him? I guess you mentioned you'd helped him put his campaign in Dillon when you were at college.
Yeah, when he was running for lieutenant governor, and then when I ran for office, he was lieutenant governor. And I think my first governor's ball I went to was 1968 for that election. I remember the girl. I took you to Weibo, Montana. Just a friend. We had a nice time, but the snow fell that year. And Helen has a strange way of removal, snow removal. If God put it there, eventually he'll take it up. They had no plows. You were stuck on a flat street at the governor's ball in 68. But I got there... and Tom was running for, well, I got my first session, Forrest was governor and Tom was lieutenant governor, and then Tom approached me, and I really didn't get too involved because I was still involved in legislature, and it was shortly thereafter that Forrest Anderson announced that he was not going to seek re-election, and I really think it was because the polls had showed that Judge would beat him head on. Huh. And Judge, I'm trying to think, I believe he picked Bill Christensen.
That's right.
To be his lieutenant governor.
Who had been minority leader in the House, had
yeah.
he?
Yeah, he was our minority leader. Yeah. And at that time, you didn't run as a team, still. Now, the Constitution will pass in 72, and from then on, you have to actually, because later on, the team that had the biggest problem, well, in the 50s, the team that had the biggest problem was Hugo Aronson and Paul Gannon. Hugo Aronson being the Republican and Paul Cann being the Democrat, and Hugo didn't want to leave the state because Paul would fire some of his employees and hire his own, even if Hugo was only gone for 3 days. But the next governors that had a problem was Tim Babcock and James, Ted James. They were of the same political party, but they didn't get along. Ted, I think, was of the much more progressive Republican, and Tim, who's a dear friend and I like him very much, was of the more standard conservative wing of the party. But I think it was good that they finally, it would be silly today if we elected Obama and Pavin. You know, it just would not make sense. Well, it'd be silly if we elected Pavin anyway. But Judge ran and picked Christensen, and I was very active in that campaign, as well as for my second election. Judge, in my opinion, he used to have I think his most interesting success or asset was he surrounded himself by very competent, good staff. And good staff that could deal with the legislature, whether it was Ron
Richards,
the whole myriad of them. I liked his surrounding, his staff. He also would come to us, and he'd have the Butte delegation. And when I say Butte, I always mean Butte Anaconda, Sandy Mearns, Red Minahan. He'd have us over at least once every 2 weeks, usually once a week, because he liked our company, and he liked the fact we liked to drink beer, and we liked to shoot pool. So he'd have a dinner upstairs, and we'd go downstairs, the delegation.
Over the governor's mansion.
Over the governor's mansion, which, by the way, isn't much of a mansion.
Yeah.
But, and he had some Anaconda roots. And so he was extremely sympathetic to our plight, not just Butte's plight, but the valley out there, the Warm Springs Hospital, the prison, state employees. And we were always fighting for those. And I was on appropriations, as I mentioned, and I'm trying to fight for those. And so Tom was extremely sympathetic. The one time I do remember, we took over the majority. And so I became chairman of my subcommittee. And that was after the new con. We never had any of this don't look at the bill stuff anymore that the Republicans had in 71. We all worked together. And I remember his mother coming to me. The Republicans, and it was very close in the Senate, I think the Senate was Republican. So whatever I got through the House was going to have trouble in the Senate, vice versa. And so I got $10,000 in for Tom Judge's recreation account. Now, all that meant was grocery account, really, that he got to have entertain people. And I remember his mother's name was Blanche. And she came up to me and says, "How can you be so disloyal to Tom? Why, $10,000 isn't enough, you know." And at that time, as a school teacher, I think I was making $7,000 or $7,400 a year. And I thought, ma'am, Blanche, that's the best I can get out of this, because they're over there ready to chop. There will be no food budget. And you didn't have to. There's nothing that says by law the governor gets anything but a salary, and I think maybe someplace he gets to live in the governor's mansion. I don't even know if we have to pay the power bill, but anyway, we're paying everything. And she was very upset with me over that. And the other interesting thing that year, that would be 75, I think. Bob Woodall was the attorney general, and he was after this big probe about workers' comp lawyers. And I don't know, he was kind of a pushy little guy. And so I was chairman of his budget, along with all the elected office holders, and he wanted to hire this fellow, Dick DeZeevy. And Dick DeZeevy was a dear friend of mine. He'd been a former majority leader in the Senate.
Yeah, Democrat senator from
Great Falls.
Yeah.
And he, huge fellow. In fact, to regress a little bit, during that sales tax special session, the opposition for the sales tax was led by Dick DeZeevy and the Democrats in the Senate who controlled it, and Big Jim Lucas, who controlled the House, and
was the Republican
Republicans
in favor of the
sales tax. And I remember I made one mistake, and well, it's not the only mistake I made in my life, but when they were offering something for the sales tax, and I got up and said, "Beware of Greeks bearing gifts," and Jim Lucas was of Greek origin and immediately called me into his office and said, "Don't start making remarks about Greeks," and I, okay. But anyway, my suggestion to that special session was...
Did you do that on purpose, or did...
Yeah, I did it on purpose. But I thought, show how educated I was. But I thought, my solution in that special session, remember, it went on and on, and 90% of the legislature in that special session in 71 had nothing to do. Taxation was the committee meeting. Appropriation wasn't meeting. We'd go out to Gates of the Mountains. Sonny Lockerman was a dear friend of mine, and we'd go boating, and you check in once a day and leave again. But finally it got to a point, it didn't look like they'd have a compromise, and the compromise was really horrible for Jim Lucas because it ruined his political career. The sales tax, I knew, would be defeated overwhelmingly. But
the compromise was to place it on the ballot, mm-hmm. so that people had the opportunity to choose between an increase in their income tax or a sales
tax. A surtax on the income tax, and it was a sizable surtax. I think it was a 30% surtax.
That's what I remember, yeah.
And they chose the surtax rather than the sales tax.
It was a 2% sales tax, and I think a 35% surtax
on their income. Yeah. And overwhelmingly, about 75-25.
Yeah.
But I thought, when it wasn't looked like a compromise, here's these two great big men, DeZeevy and Lucas, put them in the ring. Who's ever still standing, their plan goes. But you know, that was my simplistic, beautiful approach to get it over with. But I'm going back to Woodall, and he was going to pay Dick DeZeevy, I believe, $60,000 to be the work comp investigative lawyer. I looked up, of course, because I'm running the budget, and Woodall, as Attorney General, was making $30,000. So I had to, you know, I like a little drama. And we have this relatively small room, and Senator Pat Regan from Billings was my vice chairman. So we had both houses in 75. It was after the Nixon debacle, yeah. And everything went all right. And all the cameras are there because Woodall was going to present his budget. So I'm chairman. I kind of get to run things. And I said, I want to ask one question after they gave a spiel. Is DeZeevy this good? And Woodall, well, he certainly is. And I said, is he twice as good as you are? And he said, well, what do you mean, Senator? I said, you're paying him twice as much as you're making. He picked the budget book up and threw it at me.
Seriously?
In front of the TV. Not threw it in my head, threw it on. And he said, I don't have to put up with this. And stormed out, and all the papers liked it. And then I saw him later down at Jorgensen's. And he'd had a few, no question about it. And they wanted me to go to the press on it because Rex Manuel was there and one-on-one. But he came to me and he says, I'm going to tell you something. Either I get what I want or I'm going to have my highway patrol keep a very close eye on you. And so I said, you know, you've had a few. But the next day, Rex repeated it. And Larry Fassbender came up and said, I think you should go to the press and say you were threatened because of your position. I said, you know what? Anybody who's had a few drinks in their life isn't going to take that too serious, so I wouldn't do that, and I'm glad I did.
Yeah. That's an interesting story.
Yeah, it is, because they really pressured me to go to the press and say, this is the kind of guy. And I.
Do you know what the outcome of the appropriation was?
We gave it to him, $1 million. And to me, there are some Democrats who said we shouldn't be doing it. And in my opinion on that issue, as chairman of the committee, if you don't give it to them, you've convicted every single person whose name has been brought up. If you do give it to them, you're giving them $1 million rope to hang himself. And as a result, I was right.
Yeah.
We gave him $1 million, no convictions other than one with Luke McEwen, nobody else. Waste of $1 million, but if we didn't do it, I think it would have been one of those things. Everyone was guilty. The Democrat lead, the majority prevented an investigation.
Yeah.
So I don't think he had an opportunity to say no.
Yeah. Well, good story. So anything else connected with Governor Judge J.D.?
I remember the scandal. I think it was over carpet. He put a brand new fancy carpet in, and we had to fight for that. He killed something, a deer, an elk, or something out of season. We had to fight over that. Then he had some matrimonial problems later on. But overall, of all the governors I've served under, I thought he was the best for my area, best for Butte Anaconda.
And you got to actually know him personally.
Oh, yes.
Dinners in his house.
We'd have a few drinks or lunch together, even after he was governor. I was considered, I'm sure, as one of his friends. Yeah.
Then you also served with Governor Schwinden when you.
Yeah, now Governor Schwinden was quite a contrast to Governor Judge. I was running for Secretary of State at the same time Governor Schwinden was running for governor against Tom Judge. Tom Judge and I are pretty close friends.
Schwinden had been lieutenant governor.
Has been lieutenant governor.
In 1980, he ran for governor and yep.
beat his former boss.
In the primary, and that was the same year you were running for Secretary of
State.
Right,
and I won the primary. But Ted Schwinden kind of, I think he was a good governor, but he was more Republican, to my mind, than Democrat. He also dried up all the money for us B offices. And I mean, he won, but I lost, and George Ruth Rice lost, and you know he won, but everybody else lost.
She was running for superintendent of public instruction. As an incumbent,
and lost.
Lost to Argenbright.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but Schwinden was a very close ally of Francis Bardineau, and Francis Bardineau had tried for many years to do damage to the valley, meaning Warm Springs, the prison, the whole works. Closing Galen. Right off the bat, they came up with they wanted to close Galen, which is one of our facilities we had in the valley. And Galen was at that time for dryout for people needing recuperation from alcoholism. And we stopped the three straight sessions that the Schwinden administration, Kurt Chisholm was the director, and he hated to do it. But he had to come in and say, we think Galen should close, and Red Manahan and I'm in appropriations, and then that time, I'm in the Senate now, in the 80s. I went to the Senate in 82, so Manahan is on appropriations in the House, and I'm on the Senate, so he's got, and I represented half of Anaconda at one time. Half of my House district was Anaconda, and half was Butte. So we had to fight that. So Schwinden and I didn't get along over those issues particularly. He was Bardineau's, whatever Bardineau wanted, the governor would propose, and we'd have to defeat.
And the economy was declining.
Oh, yes.
So the state was in a real predicament in terms of financing.
Yeah.
And he didn't want to raise taxes.
No, he wanted to be as conservative as you could.
So he was real conservative with the money, and Francis Bardineau, his personal friend, was chairman of the House Appropriations Committee, and the two of them really put a lock on the money box.
Yeah.
And that worked to the detriment of
my area.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Schwinden was never a great pro-labor man. He was always endorsed by labor, depending, regardless of who his opponent was, because some of those years, and in the 80s, the AFL-CIO was, you know, kind of a right arm of the Democratic Party, you know.
Yeah.
I don't know that in the last 10 years they've endorsed some Republicans, but prior to that I don't think they endorsed very many Republicans at all. But Schwinden, I think, was a very effective governor and extremely popular governor. Well, when he ran for re-election, I think it was against Jack Ramirez, he won overwhelmingly. Although Ramirez had a very difficult name for politics, really. Mm-hmm. He was Portuguese, but people assumed he was of Mexican descent or something, Ramirez. And
yeah.
I think that was just a tough name to run on in Montana.
Yeah.
And then comes Stan Stevens.
Before we get to Stevens, though, J.D., how would you contrast Schwinden to Judge. You said they were very different.
Very different in so far as Schwinden was as not as, at least to us, as personal, as friendly, visiting with us. What do I need? What can I do for you? Tom Judge was.
Judge was as I remember, very congenial, very gracious, very friendly, easygoing. And Ted Schwinden maybe a little more businesslike.
A little more businesslike and really a little more rural. I mean, he wasn't that city, he didn't know how to deal with delegations such as ours. Maybe a lot of people don't. Tom Judge had a great man named Jim Flynn that would contact us. He was from Dillon. We served with him from Dillon. He was in the house.
From Dillon, yeah.
And just a great rapport.
Yeah.
Schwinden didn't have
so
that.
So there weren't any more dinners over at the governor's mansion. I mean, private dinners.
If I went to one, it was, you know, the big reception,
yeah,
but the,
yeah.
the camaraderie type get-togethers ceased.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Stevens.
Certainly one of the closest friends I've had in the legislature was Stan Stevens when we were serving in the Senate together. One of the people who didn't talk to me practically for 4 years was the same man when he became governor. And I think it was primarily over the sales tax. I've got to add, and I know we're going here, but I've got one of my something I was most noted for was my opposition to the sales tax. And it wasn't just because I like to orate, which I like to orate, but also because Butte, out of any place in the state of Montana, if you want to put it on the ballot, let's put it on the ballot, because we would vote it down, you know, usually 4-1, about 80-20. And why Stan Stevens, for 1 minute, thought that I would ease off on the sales tax, it virtually was my speech of the session, because everybody waited for it, and I never used to practice a speech, but I'd actually think of some things the night before on the sales tax. You know, a dog is a dog is a, no, a rose is a rose is a rose, and a dog is a dog is a dog, and this damn bill is a dog. And so Stan didn't run on the sales tax, so I wasn't sure why he was so offended when I was opposed to it. But shortly after he had a terrible beginning, by the way.
Yeah.
Probably the worst beginning I've ever seen a governor have to go through. Is my dear friend Alan Colstead, rest his soul. He said, you know, we could have searched the entire state of Montana looking for a guy who was married to two women at the same time and had a master's degree that he never had. And he says, we only would have come up with one, and that's the one we found, and I forget his name.
Ray Shackelford.
Shackelford.
And they made him director of the budget office.
And
he wasn't even real well qualified for that.
And then he had this fellow from Shelby that was selling things that he shouldn't have been selling.
Mike Letson.
Letson.
Director of the Department.
I mean, he
of
just had a terrible beginning.
Marketing things out of the Commerce Department.
It was just a horrible beginning.
Had another guy that was making obscene telephone calls that was the director of the Department of Health.
Yeah. It was just, Colstead was just flat. And then the other thing, Colstead, who was my close friend, as you know, he was kind of shut out from the governor. And he was lieutenant governor.
Yeah.
And he was kind of, Steve Yackel.
Was the chief of staff.
Was the chief of staff. And he was almost Nixonian into his approach to access to the governor.
Yeah.
And so when I came out vigorously against the sales tax and gave one of my ranting and ravings, Stan was very cool to me after that.
Huh.
And he also had a tough time with Senator Van Valkenburg and some of these people, and you know, some of
them. You remember the airplane incident?
The airplane incident, and I remember the limousine incident.
What do you remember about them?
I remember the limousine, and a dear friend of mine, I can't think of his name right now, was Stan's driver, Savage, Don Savage, and he
Don
was
Ramage.
Don Ramage, and he was. And people made much ado about nothing. The rent was virtually the same, but they wanted the image of Stan riding in a big Lincoln Town car.
Let's see, I'm just remembering now that the Ford Motor Company offered to lease a car to the governor of every state in the country.
Whatever kind they wanted.
Whatever kind they wanted.
Same price.
For the same price.
Yeah.
So you could have the common touch, I suppose, if you wanted to drive a regular Ford sedan. But they thought.
Yeah, I would jump on a Ford Fairlane instead of a Lincoln Continental any day.
But,
who wouldn't?
But they thought,
yeah,
if we could get to Lincoln for the same price, why wouldn't
absolutely
we do it?
And I would have done the same thing.
And so what was the dispute? I mean,
it was the image. He needs a driver, he needs this.
I see.
And I thought the Democrats, if you recall, I never took cheap shots on party issues because I had too many friends on both sides of the aisle. But the Democrats, particularly Stan's former colleagues in the Senate, I thought came out after him pretty hard. He got very angry and mean, and as a result, he isolated himself even further.
Do you remember, this all just come back to me now, and I don't know how it will work on our recording here, but take just a minute to tell. I do remember there was a discussion about this on the floor of the Senate, and that had something to do with whether the automobile would be driven by a chauffeur or not. Mm-hmm. And Bruce Crippen, who was the floor leader on the Republican side at the time, said, he stood up, and he said, well, members of the Senate, he said, let me illustrate for you why it's not a good idea to have Governor Stevens driving his own automobile, especially a large one like a Lincoln. He said, this is what he looks like behind the wheel. And then he sat down on the floor, and just the top of his head was sticking up above his desk. And, of course, everybody in the Senate just laughed. But Stevens was such a small man that, you know.
Yeah. And that was, but I remember the last day of the second session of Stan's, it was kind of an angry evening.
Yeah.
And because I was close friend to the governor when he was senator, I was on the goodbye governor party, you know, the goodbye.
When the heralding committees go around, and so you.
And Stan was, you know, he didn't have great color to begin with, but if he was purple then, he was. As Colstead used to say, looked like a Martian the night we came in and we said goodbye, because it was a bitter ending to a session.
And the stress seemed to make him kind of red in the face.
And I thought his health, I was concerned about his health.
Tell us about the airplane.
I don't recall all of the incidents about the airplane.
There was some kind of a concern that the airplane needed to have a lot of money put in to mm-hmm. make it safe, or whether he needed to have another airplane or not. And so you mentioned Senator Van Valkenburg somehow are involved in that, and I remember that too.
Yeah, and I don't remember the details, except I didn't agree that. See, I think whoever the governor is, regardless of party, should have the safest possible airplane.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a big state, and we've lost a lot of people in airplanes, be it Governor Nutter, be it Waldemeyer, who was campaigning for governor. Be it Bud Asbevig, I know a lot of people.
He represented, he was a crop duster, was killed.
I always say, I don't know how I'm going to go, but I know how I'm not going to go is riding my old airplane and crashing, I can tell you that. That's one safe way. But, I mean, I just think that the safest plane is what we ought to have in the state of Montana. So I was not of the party that wanted to pick games over an airplane, whether it should be refurbished, whether it should be another one, whether it should be a King Air, whether it should be a Queen Air. So I didn't. I was going to vote with the governor, and he knew it.
Yeah. I don't even remember exactly how that came out, honestly.
Let me say this while we're going. Yeah. The one interesting thing, I think, and I think it would be of interest to historians, there's a distinct difference between, I think, one's attitude who serves in the House, and I was in the House for 8 years, as the person who's in the Senate, and I was in the Senate for 19 years. I think truly you become more independent in the Senate than you do in the House. Now, if you were in the House maybe 30 years, you would be, but I still don't see quite the independence. This day to day, I don't see near the camaraderie and the respect given back and forth between colleagues, be they fellow Democrats in my case or Republicans. I think you're terribly independent in the Senate. I mean, many a time. I'll give you one example. Jack Gault was just elected president of the Senate. And Errol Gault, his son, was coming up to be chairman of the Fish and Game Committee, I believe.
Yeah.
And we went to a caucus, and I'm very close friends of Jack Gault. And I think it was Senator Jurgensen was our minority leader and said, I think there was 23 of us or 22 Democrats. And he says, I want us all to vote united against Errol Gault. Well, I said, why? Because we're going to show then that we don't think he's, our sportsmen are against him. And I didn't have that much input for my sportsmen. So he said, is that agreed upon? Well, I raised my hand and said, no, it isn't. He said, what do you mean? I said, I'm going to tell you something. I don't know as much about politics as some of you boys do, but the president of the Senate just sat and got sworn in the last couple of days.
This is his son.
And this is his son, and you're going to insult the president of the Senate with 3 days after he takes office by not giving him a Democrat vote and by showing him he's going to get it anyway. He's got every Republican and he's got me. And all of a sudden, Senator Pippenich says, I'm not voting that way either. J.D. makes more sense than any of us. So all of a sudden, the whole thing fell apart. But I thought, how dumb a thing that was. It was just absurd. And it got back to Jack Paulson. He called me in his office. Now, you don't know who it was. It was Paul Boylan or whoever. But it got back to Jack, and he said, I appreciate that. He said, that was a good show. He said, that would have been a dumb thing for them Democrats to do.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I'm glad that happened. Mark Roscoe.
Mark Roscoe, I think, was probably truly the most articulate governor. And I appreciate oratory. I appreciate his... I think he got a little more credit than he had coming. Certainly, Mark has to take much of the blame for deregulation. He's never... He had a... One thing about Roscoe, he had a tremendous... What do you call the stuff that doesn't stick?
Teflon.
A tremendous. He introduced the sales tax. Senator Crippen and I fought for hours on the floor over it. Senator Crippen told me I was out of touch and that I didn't know what I was talking about. And so, of course, we put it on the ballot, and I think we had something with it, too. Didn't we have a 7% solution with the sales tax, and the public voted with the 7% solution? And I was right, and it even was defeated in Senator Crippen's own precinct, so I'm sure he was maybe the one out of touch. I reminded him that several times. But Roscoe was the sponsor of that, went on TV. It went down again, 75 or 73 to 27, or overwhelmingly. Teflon.
Yep.
Bora. He introduced and proposed and went on the air to deregulation and went before the committee and testified, we've got to save these jobs. This is going to be a major corporation, touch America, blah, blah, blah. This was a disaster. And yet, he left with one of the highest ratings as governor. And he single-handedly picked Judy Martz as the next governor. He could have picked anybody. It would have been, because he was going to be Chip Laylock, rest his soul. And then Chip died and Judy Jacobs. And he was going to win by 60-40 no matter what. And I think he won by 70-30.
Yeah.
You know, now people, I understand, I hear some people saying, well, that damn Roscoe. But I didn't hear that damn Roscoe for 8 years when he was governor. He was quite popular. And very popular, one of the reasons, is he had a great connection with Carroll College, which gave a great connection to the Catholic community, which gave a great connection to Butte. So it wasn't near as strong as most Republicans would get beat up. But Mark Roscoe and I had a great relationship. He had us over to his house. Now that this is... Swindon is gone. And Stan, we went to the governor's house a couple times with Stan.
Talking about the Butte delegation?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one time, Roscoe used to like to smoke a pipe, and I used to like to have a cigarette. So we went down in the basement several times and had a puff. And that's when he told me that story that everybody's heard about when he decided to run for attorney general, and his dad was pretty much on his deathbed. And Mark went and he said, I'm going to run for attorney general. And Dad said, Mark. He says, good Lord, you've ran for Chief Justice, you've ran for Judge. And he says, but we're back. Yeah, he says, I guess if that's the bad news. And he says, no, Dad, that's not the bad news. He says, what is the bad news? He says, I'm going to run as a Republican. And according to Mark, and he verified it, he said something to the effect, you couldn't have broke my heart more if you told me you were gay than that's running as a Republican. So that's what I understand.
I heard that same story too from him. No, that's great.
And let me say one other thing I was going to mention earlier. Truly, when I went to Helena, I'd lived in a town that saw very few average Republicans. I'm not saying we didn't know who the bad guys were, because they were the rich guys on the Montana Power Company, John Coretta or Jack Redknapp, but we didn't know any. And I'd never known a kid that I sat next to in school that said our folks are Republicans. So I went to Helen at 23. Now, I met Lawton Dillon, you know, but I started getting the idea, well, maybe there are some normal people that are calling themselves Republicans. I've never heard of such a thing. So I went to Helen really looking for the, quote, office holders to have some kind of spikes coming out their ear or their foreheads and a tail, because I was told they're bad people. They're just basically bad people. And then I met several. I remember Henry Cox. He was from Billings, a fine gentleman, an educator like myself.
State representative.
State representative. And I lost my first bill that was trying to repeal the lien law, which they take away people's homes if they're on welfare before they give them any assistance. And Representative Kelleher from Great Falls was opposed to it.
Kelleher
defeated me the first time I tried it, second time I passed it. And I thought that was one of my best things, is the poor people, the last little vestige of dignity they have is these little homes. But I lost it the first time, and Henry Cox came up, and we went out and shot a game of pool, and he's lost your first bill. And I remember that TV commercial where the little kid is just downtrodden and someone gives him, I don't know, a Coca-Cola or something. But Henry patted, lifesaver, Henry patted me, he says that you'll win more than you're going to lose. I also remember a great advice by Gene Turnage. I'd met him after I lost, maybe that was the same bill, he was in the Senate. And I was still angry, you know, I don't get angry anymore, but I was angry then. And Gene Turnage said, J.D., I think you got a lot of potential. Because you fight for your causes, but you know you can't be getting angry. There'll be another day. And he said, "Remember the 11th commandment." And I said, "What is that, Senator?" And he said, "Thou shalt not take thyself too seriously. There'll be another day." And I thought that was a great piece of advice for a young legislator, because you can't. And through the years, Dennis Nathy, Senator from Redstone, Montana, was my roommate, and I eulogized him, and you know, he was dead when we were living together in the 1993 session.
You came home and found him dead
in bed. Alan Colstead and I would have lunch two or three times a week together. You and I have been friends for almost 40 years now, and I found that the party doesn't make the person. The person is who makes themselves, and I truly have found my life has been gifted by having served in the state legislature.
We're getting close to the end of our tape, but do you have any thoughts on Judy Martz?
I didn't know her well, and I never served with her because I left in 99.
I see.
And she came, her first session was 201. She was very complimentary to those of us who had just left, Joe Quillacy, Bobby Pavlovich, J.D. Lynch, because she was looking to more of that bipartisanism that Butte was always famous for. Yeah. And when we all left at once, it didn't seem to be there as much.
I'm sure that's true.
Dan Harrington was never truly bipartisan.
Yeah.
And so she was disappointed that she expected to have someone to work with her.
Yeah. As you look back, what do you see? I mean, is there a common theme or a common...
I think that is looking at it now, the best times of the legislature are behind them. And I don't like to admit that, because I would like to think there are better times ahead. I think this terrible, terrible animosity and the viciousness in the animosity is just something that is not going to serve Montana well.
When you say that, there's extreme partisanship now, and sometimes...
And it's not just partisanship, it's personal
hatred
for the other party. If they're a member of the party, they must be wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, I told you, I went there with a little idea, but these people, they're so at each other's throats. They don't seem to have any camaraderie like we had of going out and having a beer together or having lunch together.
No.
Even though Crippen and I would fight all day. And say where we're going to meet after. But we did our job for our people. We let our views, but we were never, we disagreed, but we're never just hostile and hated each other for life. I think that's a mistake they're making, and I think they'll regret it. I think very few of them will be able to sit down and have a conversation like you and I've had today and say what a wonderful experience they had.
Do you think term limits is an explanation for this?
I think term limits is, only because it eliminated some of that continuity.
Yeah.
Like our whole delegation was wiped out.
Yeah.
But then if people look about it, they didn't need term limits because the average legislator only served 4 years to begin with. It was old people like me.
Yeah.
That Butte was like the South in yesteryear. They elected them young and kept them a long time.
Yeah, right.
And but I really think term limits eliminated that continuity. I also think it takes away your ability to build the friendships that I was able to because I was there for 30 years.
Yeah, me too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, me too.
We built some great friendships.
What do you see as you look into the future?
I think I see it, unless several, it won't take one can't do it, it'll take several to say, you know, can't we start getting together on a friendly basis, talking over our disagreements, stop sniping at each other for only the sake of sniping. You know, if you're going to snipe at someone, have a good reason to snipe. Don't just do it because it's today's Wednesday and I haven't sniped at anybody today. Have a reason. And if not, I think that the other thing I notice, which is different than in my day, is you don't see any, hardly, of the social, of the freshmen and going to the receptions that they have early with the whole legislature, so you mm-hmm. could have some meetings with each other. I don't see that.
They don't do that anymore?
They do it, but I think people are told, watch out for those lobbyists. Don't take anything. Don't have a glass of pop.
So you've got just a big dinner that everybody's invited to,
and
Chamber
only,
of Commerce
oh,
or the...
Oh, and I bet they're going to cut down the next few years. But out of a possible 300 with spouses,
yeah.
But most of us always didn't have our spouses there, you'll see 30 people out of 150 legislators, and usually they're the same ones.
Yeah, because we all went to those.
And you got to mix with somebody.
Yeah.
I think the social conservatives, the far-right religious people, are told not to or feel that it's some type, you know, maybe they think by taking a piece of chicken, it's tainting them. I figured I want to be equally tainted. So I take it from the AFL-CIO and the Montana Power, and I vote with the labor. No problem.
Well, JD, you're my valued friend.
Thank you, and it's good.
Appreciate your service.